Psalm 127. We're familiar with this psalm, entitled the message this morning, Fatherhood, Life's Manly Calling. Psalm 127. Again, we're familiar with it, but let's go ahead and read it one more time. We'll pray, and we'll work through what God has for us in this passage this morning. Psalm 127. It's a song of ascents, it tells us. It tells us that it's of Solomon, either written by Solomon or written for Solomon. We're not told which. Either one would make sense. Verse 1. Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord, the fruit of the womb a reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. As we stand here in 2018, we understand that feminism has waged really an historically unprecedented war against men, against fatherhood. But I think you'll find the current statistics just a little bit surprising. I was looking just this week at a Pew Research poll here. And as far as parenting as an identity, you'll see that men, dads, consider parenting part of their identity almost to the same degree that women do. 57% versus 58%. I think these statistics are a little bit surprising as well. On the whole, dads say a little bit more than moms do that parenting is rewarding. They find parenting rewarding all the time. And again, just a little bit higher percentage, 5%, a little higher than moms. Dads say that parenting is enjoyable. It's rewarding. It's enjoyable. Men find parenting a part of their identity. Again, these might be surprising statistics, but we've given two different years, 1965, 2016. You'll see that back in 1965, about 9 hours of the 24, or 9 hours of the 9% of their work-related stuff was paid work, housework a little bit less, and dads back in 1965 averaged about 2.5 hours with their children, average hours spent per week. Today, it's more like 8 hours. Still behind moms, but much more than it was just a generation ago. But parenting presents a challenge probably more unique today than it has been in the past because whereas in the past it was about 50-50 as far as those who were dual-income, single-income homes, today at least two-thirds of the American culture has both parents working. About 5% has only the mother employed, which means that about 40% then is just the father's employed. One father, about 27%. But not only are homes having both parents parenting more, but both parents are working more, which means that it's more complicated. Parenting is more complicated than it has been in the past. This shouldn't be a surprise. Fathers, on the whole, don't really want their little boys trained up to look like little girls. Moms are more interested in their daughters having the opportunities that boys have, though you'll see that dads don't mind so much if girls play with Tonka trucks. That's not that big a deal to them. They still know that they're wearing skirts at other times of the day. But it's interesting that dads are the one who are holding back the society from moving to a transgender or gender exclusive, removing those gender exclusive roles in society. Psalm 127 is filled up with manly imagery. They're sweating workmen, they're skilled craftsmen, There's focused watchmen, tireless farmers, disciplined warriors, wise elders. As we move through this psalm, their work is valued, but it's not valued inordinately. Work isn't the chief value of this psalm. They're called to labor, but they're not called to labor excessively. They're called to labor within limits. They're productive, but they're not productive endlessly. God's aware that there's a productivity cap on people. And they're effective. They're effective in the work that they do, but they're not effective independently. They're only effective as they do what they do, dependent upon God. They work hard, they walk by faith, they communicate values in the context of community. And most importantly, they pass the baton to another generation through their families. Because the greatest work of any man is depending upon God while forging relationships in the service of others. The psalm breaks down into three sections. Verse 1, we're going to see that the writer, either David or Solomon, probably Solomon, illustrates for us man's greatest work. He's going to use two pictures. He's going to use the picture of a builder and that of a watchman to help illustrate for us what is man's greatest work. We're going to move to verse 2, and we're going to see that he's going to impress upon the entire culture, the entire society, the entire community, what it means for this work to be their work. And then we're going to move down to verses 3 through 5, and we're going to see that Solomon then clarifies for men the greatness of this work. Depending upon God while forging relationships in the service of others. That's where we're going this morning. Let's see how this all works. He starts out in verse 1 by illustrating for men their greatest work. And he starts by using the illustration of a builder. Verse 1, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. He illustrates it by a builder, and maybe it's even better to have the term a craftsman, but the responsibility here is house building. And you're familiar with a carpenter. There at the early morning hours, out there before the sun gets too hot, and yet working through and toiling through the heat of the day, taking off his shirt so that he can wring it out and wipe his brow, putting on the bandana, putting on the hat, keeping the sun out of his eyes, laboring from morning till night. The job is house building. It's a hard work. But the word that's used for house, the Hebrew word house, has the idea of not just a structure, but what takes place within the structure. A house that is a home. We could even use the term household. The same word has the same idea. Adam Clark points this fact out. He says the words bane or son, bat in daughter, bayit, house in Hebrew, all come from the same root, bana, to build. Sons and daughters build up households and constitute families as much and as truly as stones and timber constitute a building. It's the job of a man to build a house for his family, but not just to build a structure. Dad, it's your job to make sure that your house is a home. Now, we don't really associate that connection. If you've ever been into a guy's dorm, you ever drop off your kids or go visit your kids in the guy's dorm? We used to, back at Pillsbury, have the guy's dorm at Christmas time. They would open up first the guy's dorm, and everybody would, they'd have an open house after church on Wednesday night, right around Christmas time. And everybody would go in the guy's dorm, and they would be able to see where the guys live, how the guys live, and they cleaned it up, and you walk through, and if you were lucky, it was clean. But that was about it. And they always did the guys first. It's Christmas time. Some of them might have a string of lights maybe around their desk or something. But it was pretty stark. It was pretty bare bones. Because guys in a guy's dorm, they go there, they eat, they sleep, they belch, and they don't do homework. They do that somewhere else. Okay? That's about all that happens in a guy's dorm. They watch TV, they game, and that's about it. Right after the guy's dorm, they close that down. Everybody would go over to the girl's dorm. You'd walk through the girl's dorm for the open house, and there you have this crepe paper. You have these dreamy lights. You have different kinds of fabrics that I can't even pronounce, different colors that you wouldn't even think they sold. And all of this, they've got their whole doors wrapped in Christmas wrapping paper, and you wonder, how long did it take them to do that? How much, you know how many pizzas they could have bought for all those different things that they put up around it? Okay, that's just how guys think. When we think of making a house a home, we usually think of that being ladies' work. But the Bible doesn't see it that way. The Bible says, Dad, you're responsible for whether or not your shell of a house has a family in it that constitutes it as a home, a place of security, a place of rest, a place where values are transferred and cultivated. Dad, that's your job. The realm is the home, the family. There's Solomonic overtones, which are pretty obvious in this. Again, the psalm is written by Solomon, or for Solomon, probably by Solomon, who is responsible for building God's temple, the house of the Lord. But Solomon, living under the roof of David, is very, very conscious what the purpose of this house is. It's not just to be the most beautiful building in all of the world, though it will be when it's all said and done. But the purpose of this fine structure with great stones, with elaborate overlays of gold, silver, bronze, huge lavers, all the activity that's going to take place there. Solomon is very, very aware that this building isn't just a building. It's a building where relationship happens. Dad, your house is a place where relationship happens. If it doesn't, you have a house. If you do, you have a home. And the one who makes the difference in that process isn't primarily your wife. It's you. He says, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. The virtue in this house building is skilled labor. It's craftsmanship. I remember working for a fellow. My grandfather got me the job as I was working one summer out in western Minnesota. He got me connected, apprenticed to the guy who built his house. And I had already done some construction. We show up at a job, and we're putting in this beautiful oak board. We put it on the banister, the railing. And it's not square. It's not fitting quite right. It's sticking out a little bit too far on one side. And I pointed it out to the contractor, asked what he wants us to do. It's already secured pretty good. We have to rip it up, grab another one. He said, no, we'll fix it. And he goes over, and he grabs a belt sander. Cobs it up. That's good enough. The board was probably a 60, 70, 80 piece, dollar piece of wood sitting there on that banister. Just took it like it was an old piece of pine. That's good enough. About 1 week after that, I was done working for the guy. I said, this isn't going to work. This isn't how we do what we're supposed to do. Dad, you're not cobbing together a home. This isn't shanty town that you're raising your family in. You've got to be skilled at what you do. You're not just a construction worker. You're a craftsman. You understand which way the grain goes. You understand how the glues work. You're the one who knows how to use the different tools that are appropriate for the task. I was working for one fella, Weinberg, the guy that I learned construction with, and he would call just about anything a hammer. A crescent hammer, because you can use a crescent wrench for anything, especially to hammer. Dad, you don't use a crescent wrench as a hammer. You use a crescent wrench as a crescent wrench. You know when to apply the pressure. You know when to ease off. You've got the feel. You've got the touch. You know how to do what you're called to do. The idea of building here is to raise up, to build. It requires knowledge of materials, tools, timings, methods. It requires skill. How to use those materials. How to use those tools. How to do things in the right sequence with the right methods. The word labor here has the idea of toiling, of exerting great strength, hard work. But it's hard work as something that's primarily negative. Sweating, uncomfortable, working hard, toiling long, exerting great effort to get the job done. This building and laboring then become metaphors for working hard to make sure that the job gets done. Guys, we like to think of ourselves like that, don't we? Whatever it takes, I'm going to sweat it through. I'm going to grin and bear it. We're going to get this job done. We're going to dig in there and toil till the job is done. Moody writes, most people think that effective work is conditioned on their activity. Guys, maybe we could just stick our names in there. Most guys think that effective work is conditioned upon our activity, not God's activity. Not only ineffectiveness, but also worry, stress is the result of not living according to the perspective of depending on God. And so, in this first little couplet, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain, he says. The assessment of this great responsibility and even the great virtue exerted, the assessment is unless the project is performed with God, it's in vain. The meaning is simply empty. It's worthless. It comes to nothing. It amounts to nothing when it's all said and done. This word vain is used as a warning with regards to God's name. Don't take up the name of the Lord your God as a nothing, as a lightweight. Treat it as something that's special, that's sacred, that's honorable, that's valuable. It's not the same term that's used in Ecclesiastes. You would think, if this is written by Solomon, he would use the same term for vanity that he uses over and over and over again in the book of Ecclesiastes. Hevel, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. There's a difference, and there's a difference on purpose. Ross writes this. This focus on vanity recalls Ecclesiastes, but the two notions are different. Ecclesiastes means that we may succeed in what we seek to do, but it may then be pointless. What this psalm means is that we may not succeed in what we seek to do. Ecclesiastes simply assumes that God is not involved in what we do. The psalm assumes that God might or might not be so involved, and whether that is the case or is crucial to whether or not our efforts actually succeed. The psalm's point is, in fact, like one that recurs in Ecclesiastes and in Proverbs. And we can plan something carefully and work hard at it, be responsible and creative in implementing those plans, but everything can go wrong in a way that we could never foresee. God has to be involved in the work that we do, or the work that we do is nothing. Now, guys more than gals tend to define themselves by what they do. Women tend to define themselves by their relationships. Guys, we tend to define ourselves by what we do, our jobs, our vocations. What are you? I am a vocation. Ladies, what are you? I am a mother, daughter. We define ourselves by relationships. As ladies, as men, we define ourselves by our jobs. He says, listen, you can't define yourself by your job. Because if it succeeds, whose fault is it? It's God's. And without God, it's not going to succeed. Whatever it looks like on the outside, it's not going to succeed. It will be vanity. It will be empty. God's activity, he says, is to build the house. It's God's job to complete the project. It's God's job to complete the people. It's God's job to convert this shell of a house into a home so that it becomes that place of security, love, values, virtues. The second illustration that he gives for us is that of a watchman, one who's really, his responsibility is gatekeeping. He's standing on top of the wall. He's looking out throughout the night. He's looking far. He's looking close. He's turning around. He's making sure that nothing is sneaking up from the backside, from the outside, ready to get in. The realm here is not so much the family as it is the city, the community. Here's one who's in the service of his house, his household, his home. The other is one who's in the service of the community, the society, the city. And so it moves out, but it's still a service-oriented job. This again has Solomonic overtones. The city that Solomon is constructing this great house in is the city of David. It's the place where God would choose to place his name. In Deuteronomy 12, this is a big deal. It's the one place in all of the promised land that God would place his name. So when people thought Jerusalem, they thought of the name of the living God. They thought of the place where God resides. And so there was great emphasis on the fact that Solomon would build the temple, that Solomon would build his own house, that Solomon would construct the walls of Jerusalem in 1 Kings chapter 3, verse 1. These were the focus of his building plans. Yes, I'm going to build up my house. Yes, I'm going to build up God's house. And I'm going to make sure that the walls surrounding all of it are secure. Solomon plans and builds. And then he's going to stick watchmen on the top of these walls. But he says, when it's all said and done, we've got this beautiful house of the Lord. I've got this beautiful palace that's teeming with children. I've got it all inside a city, and I've secured it with watchmen. But if God's not the one who's guarding this city, it's all in vain. It's all worthless. The virtue is sober alertness, to watch, to stay awake through the night. But the assessment, again, it's vanity, unless God is the one who does the doing, the watching, the protecting, the securing. The one is building up something, crafting something, so that it's beautiful. It's a place that's filled with life and luxury to some extent. The other is guarding and preserving that which has been built. And both stand as essential jobs of us as men. In fact, like how one writer put it, he says that it may be that the references to the house and to the city should be construed as two images of the most fundamental tasks of life: provision for a family and protection of the community. If those two things are lost, the protection of the community, think of a war. What do you do when war ravages your nation? What do you have? And then what do you do when your family is decimated? Who are you when that's all said and done? You don't have a house, and you don't have a society. You've lost everything, haven't you? That's what he's saying. Building up your family and protecting your community. Job of the men, uniquely. Number two, he moves in verse 2 to impressing upon the men their greatest work. It's vain that you rise up early, go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. Seems that responsibility here is breadwinning. Eating bread, providing for your family the bread, eating bread for yourself, maintaining nourishment and strength. The realm here is more focused at the individual. Well, this is an agrarian society. Solomon is writing from Jerusalem, building the temple of the Lord. But as he's sending out this psalm, a psalm that's to be, in fact, it's a psalm, look at the title, it's a song of ascents. This is for all the people who would come then to worship at the temple. So he sends this song out to the different Levites located in different parts of the realm, and he gives it to them so that as they come to Jerusalem, they're singing this song, thinking about the city, thinking about the house that they're going to be a part of. because this is where relationship happens. They're excited about this. So he sent this psalm out into every corner, nook and cranny of the kingdom. But he's not writing primarily to craftsmen. He's not writing primarily to watchmen, though those are the two illustrations he gives us in the beginning. This is an agrarian society. He's writing to guys who are farmers. He's writing to men who are shepherds. He's writing to men who are tenders of vines. He's writing to men who are orchard keepers. This is an agrarian society. There's very much a farmer feel to verse 2. The virtue that's exercised here is disciplined strength. Rising up early, going to bed late, they're working hard is the idea, so that they can provide bread for themselves and for their family. But the assessment again, and this time it's fronted, is vanity. It is in vain. Not that craftsmen build, it is in vain. Not that watchmen watch, it is in vain that you would go to bed early or go to bed late. It would be in vain for you to get up early, to rush into the job of the day. This is in vain. So there's this fronting of the vanity and a narrowing of the focus. And he transfers this perspective from a generic truth, and he brings it home and he focuses it on them. Now listen, this is true for others, but this is especially true for you. This is you, Dad. It's worthless if this is how you operate. The specifics are this. It's worthless if you would rise up early. It's worthless if you go late to rest. Rising up early specifically deals with sleeping, getting out of bed so that you can rush out to do the work that you need to get done so that you can be defined by what you accomplish in a day. Dad, you're not defined by what you get done in a day. So it's pointless for you to rise up early and rush out to get it done. And Dad, you're not defined by what you get done in a day. That means it's pointless for you to go late to rest. And the word literally here is to sit. Not just to go to bed late, but the idea is not even stopping to take my lunch. Eating your lunch on the run. You've done that many times. Eating your lunch on the run. Depriving yourself of those two things that are so essential if you're going to be productive as a man. So that, he says, it's pointless if you deny yourself sleep and you deny yourself food. Why? Because God gives to his beloved sleep. He says it's pointless if you deny yourself these things and then end up eating bread, but you eat the bread. What's the term that he uses there? You eat the bread of what? There's an allusion here to the curse. The idea of working by the sweat of your brow in order simply to just eat bread. It's pointless. You're living a curse life. If this is how you're living, you're getting up early so that you can eat bread. You're staying out late. You're not sitting down. You're doing everything so hard so that you can just exist. That's not what you were designed for. That's not what God crafted you for. That doesn't reflect the image of the God that you represent. Dad, you're made for something more than just working hard, though that's a requirement. And so he calls them not to eat misery's bread, not to eat food without satisfaction, not to seek comfort without any rest, but rather to rest in God's activity. And it's God's activity to give rest. It says there at the very end of that verse, he gives to his beloved sleep. This again is an allusion to the creation blessing. This rest isn't gotten. It isn't grabbed. It isn't earned. It's granted. It's given. God gives this rest to those whom he loves. Now, there's some discussion as to whether this is the object of God's giving. God gives sleep as the direct object. God gives to his beloved sleep, or whether it's the means or the realm of God's giving. In sleep, God still gives. And both are probably appropriate, though it probably leans more toward God gives him, his beloved the commodity of rest, of sleep. That's God's doing. God gives this. And again, there's Solomonic overtones in this. This rest is for those whom God loves. But the term there is single. It's individual. He gives his beloved one sleep. And as this song goes out to every realm of the kingdom, from Solomon to all points within the kingdom, he says, listen, speaking as the beloved of the Lord, Jedidiah, the beloved one of Yahweh, let me tell you something. God can give you sleep too. Nobody was tasked with a greater job in all of Jerusalem, in all of Israel, than Solomon himself. And as Solomon is laying there on his bed, God comes to him at night while he's asleep. He says, Solomon, what would you want me to give you? He says, God, I've got too big a job. I can't get it all done. Would you just give me wisdom so that what I do counts? So that what I do matters? So that what I do doesn't need to be undone because it's you who's doing the doing in what I do? And there, as Solomon does nothing other than sleep, God gives to him. And as a result, God blesses him in every arena of life. But Solomon says, it's not just me who's the beloved of God. You too are God's beloved. And God has rest for you if in your work you take the time to sleep. If in your work you take the time to eat. Again, those two themes surface very often again in the book of Ecclesiastes. This is man's portion in his labor. To enjoy it. To sleep when it's time to sleep. To eat when it's time to eat. You know, Dad, that you exercise faith in so doing? You know that you exercise faith and you demonstrate faith to your family when you take the proper rest that's necessary? When you stop doing for God and instead rest in what God is doing for you? That's why it's so important that we take a Sabbath. Though that command is never repeated in the New Testament, it's the one command, specific command, that's not repeated, but it is expanded in the New Testament, that all that we do is in the rest of Christ. This is God's activity. There's a reference to working faith, not faithless inactivity. So he's not saying, so don't watch the walls, God's got it. Don't build a house, God's got it. He's not saying, don't pick up the hammer, but he's saying, pick up the hammer. But as you pick up the hammer, trust God to drive the nail. Because it's God's work that you're doing, and it's God's rest that he gives. Then he brings us down to the very end. And for the next three verses, he clarifies the greatness of this work. He's used some really big pictures, some really identifying pictures for guys. Guys can really jump into the mindset of the builder, working dawn till dusk. Guys can jump into the skin of the watchman who stays awake, keeps alert. Guys can jump into the skin of the farmer who's getting up before dawn, checking the fields, worrying about the cattle, taking care of the feed, making sure there's bread on the table. Guys jump into those roles. And God uses these pictures on purpose in speaking primarily to men. But in verse 3, he uses maybe a picture that we weren't prepared for. And he starts it out with the word, look! Get this perspective. Open your eyes. Men, your kids. Your kids are God's heritage. And he's gonna shift the perspective of men in three ways. He's going to call children a rich inheritance. He's going to call children a valuable reward. And he's going to call children a strategic weapon in their hands. See, guys, as important as it is to build great buildings, As important as it is to protect realms and societies, as important as it is to put food on the table, your greatest responsibility is relationships. Let me show you where that is. It's your kids. He calls children a rich heritage from the Lord. The word heritage is the word possession. We see it most often in reference to the promised land. God will give it to you as your inheritance. Often it's used of the people of Israel. They are my inheritance, God says. But the emphasis, Golden Gate says, lies in the value of what the man receives. It's inheritance. It's something that's valuable. This isn't something that you got out of the Cracker Jacks box. This isn't something that you went to the store with your mom and you have those little gumball machines and you stick the quarter in and you turn it and out comes this little plastic case and you get a eraser for 25 cents when you could have got it down the store for 15. Okay. It's not the cheap junk trinket kind of stuff that you win at the fair by knocking over milk bottles. He says what you get is something that's valuable. And it belongs to you. It really belongs to you. This is something that God gives and nobody can take away. This is your heritage. He not only calls them a heritage, he calls them a valuable reward. The word reward is a money term. It has the idea of payment or hire. Moody says, we often think, understandably enough, that children are going to cost us a lot of money. And most recently, the cost of raising a child from 0 to 18 is over $100,000 here in the United States of America. Amelia, you're an expensive child. All right. But so is Daniel. I don't know why I picked on Amelia. So is Daniel. All right. So is Kaylee. Over $100,000. So we normally think that kids are going to cost us. And they do. There's a real cost. But what the Bible says is, look, open your eyes. Get a different perspective on kids, will you? Kids are a heritage that God gives and nobody can take away because it's God's gift to you. Kids are a reward. Is there a cost? Yes. But the saying that we actually need, we need to switch our perspective. Kids don't cost us. Kids reward us. Kids are money. Okay, go take that one to the bank this afternoon. Think on that one. But God is saying, shift your perspective here. Understand what I'm doing in giving you these relationships. I'm giving you a heritage that no one can take away. I'm giving you something valuable that doesn't cost you. It actually enriches you as a person. And then he says, children are like arrows in the hand of a warrior, the children of one's youth. Look at verse 5. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. Happy, satisfied, satiated. This is a person whose lot is recognized by others as desirable. This is the exact opposite of vanity, worthless, emptiness. This is the one who is enriched. This is the one who has no reason for shame because they have great honor. But look how he develops this. He gives us two more illustrations, and the first is a warrior. Verse 4, like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. He gives to us the picture of relationships. Then he gives us the picture of this warrior. A warrior who has arrows at his ready, who puts the arrow to the bow, who's ready to send the shaft out far and long and quick that it might find its target. The responsibility here is that of protection. A warrior is one who wars against enemies. The realm is personal. He's a professional at what he does. The idea is one who has a skilled hand. He has a steady aim. He knows the distance. He's got his timing down. He knows when to let go. Dad, that's one of the hardest things, isn't it? You're raising up these young people and knowing when to let go. you've herded them, you've shepherded them, you've tended to them, you've met their needs from cradle till it's time to let them go. This skilled warrior has a skilled hand at what he does. The tools that he incorporates are the children of his youth. Interesting phrase. William Plummer, writing back before 1880, he died in 1880, listen to what he says. If the right interpretation is commonly given to this phrase, then this psalm greatly encourages early marriages. It's a growing evil of modern times that marriages are so often deferred till it's highly improbable that in the course of nature, the father can live to mold his offspring to habits of honor and virtue. Why have kids when you're young? Because they require a lot of energy. If you're old and having kids, you're shooting yourself in the foot. There's no way you can keep up with them. They're going to run circles around you. He said, guys, kids are so valuable, you can't afford to put them off till later. We think exactly backwards of that. I can't afford kids until I get my life in order, until I can afford them, right? When are you going to afford a kid? When are you going to afford a $100,000 drop in the bucket? Or three? You're not. So the Bible says, guys, get your thinking screwed in a different way. Grow up. Get married. That's part of one of the biggest things that helps you to grow up, so that you learn that life isn't just about you. And then have kids. So again, you learn life isn't just about you. Anybody grow up when you got married and had kids? Two people? Three people? Guess what? You were a selfish child, I'll bet, before you grew up and had kids. Because life was all about you. You didn't mean for it to be about you. It just was. You didn't know life any differently. But when you grow up, get married, and have kids, all of a sudden you're called to be an adult, living in an adult world, doing adult things by living for others rather than for self. But he says, these children of their youth are like arrows. Arrows, Estes gives us this description, arrows are primarily offensive weapons designed to make a predetermined impact at a long-range target. Now, in order to have this desired effect, an arrow must be carefully prepared and tested before it's placed in the quiver in anticipation of use in the battle. This is important. An arrow doesn't start out being an arrow. An arrow starts out by being a what? Not a shaft of carbonite, all right? Okay. An arrow starts out by being a stick. Well, how do most sticks look? Naughty. Okay. I like how George Swinnick says, not naughty, naughty. Okay, maybe yours was naughty, Caleb. George Swinnick writes this. Now, we know that sticks are not by nature arrows. They do not grow in this manner, but they are made in this manner. By nature, they are knotty and rugged, but by art, they are made smooth and handsome. So children by nature are rugged and untoward, but by education, they are refined and reformed. They're made pliable to the divine will and pleasure. So when he says, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them, he's not just talking about kids. Please understand that. He's not just talking about kids. He's not saying, blessed is the man whose quiver is full of sticks. He's saying, blessed is the man who takes the time to refine the sticks that he's given and hones them and shapes them and crafts them so that they become arrows in his hand. This isn't a call to see how many babies you can make in this world. That's not the point. There's some who have children that they don't train. That's not the point. The point is, every child that's entrusted to you is entrusted by God to be a rich heritage. So take the time to craft them for the long distance. Take the time to craft them so that they fly straight. Take the time to craft them so that when you release, the release is smooth and they find their target. Henry Smith writes, "Well does David call children arrows. For if they be well bred, they shoot at their enemy, at their parents' enemies. But if they be ill bred, they shoot at their parents." Isn't that what Proverbs says? "He who sires a fool sires him to his own regret. A fool is the weight and the heaviness of his mother." There is an aspect when an untrained child is not a blessing, it's a curse. He's saying, "Dad, who makes the difference? You do." What our children become depends on you, Dad. Our children are what we make them. They're represented as arrows in the hand of a mighty man, and they go the way that we direct them. Quiver, a full quiver. We've heard it many times. There's a German proverb that says, "Many children make many prayers, and many prayers make much blessing." You find yourself with your kids praying, it's not a bad place to be. Now, there's something we need to keep in mind. And an old commentator of yesteryear, Derek Kidner, writes it this way. He says, "To keep this in mind, the greater the promise of the child, the more likely these children will be a handful before they're a quiverful." You find your kids a handful? It's okay. It's your job to keep refining, keep educating, keep bending them. Because we come down to verse 5, "Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them." And then in the ESV, we have, "He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gates." Who's the he? In context, would it make sense there? Who? The man who has the children, right? Okay, the warrior who's crafted these arrows. If you have an ESV Bible, you have a footnote there. What does that footnote say? What's that? They. It's a plural here. "They shall not be put to shame when they speak with their enemies in the gates." And that's really what it is. It's a plural in the Hebrew. They will not be ashamed. Who's they? It has to include the man, right? The man who has the kids. Who else would it be? The kids along with him. That's the whole point. Okay. What happens is the man who's had these children in his youth and he's taken the energy that he has as a young man to craft that shaft so that it's straight, so that it's honed, so that it's polished, so that it flies, so that it's balanced. The one who has done this in his youth has now grown old, and they've grown up. And as he now stands in the gate, not as a young man, but as an elder of the city. Think the gate where Boaz would go, and he'd gather all the elders, and they conducted business there. They passed on virtue and values of the community. They exercised justice. He's coming as an old man, as an elder within the community. This is a public role at the city gate. His virtue is a wise mouth, speaking with enemies. He's defending against those who would undermine the virtue of the community, undermine the values of the community, undermine both community and family. But it's not just Dad who's communicating these values and justice and wisdom. It's Dad and his sons. It's the parents and their children. Dad, it's not somebody else's job to impute the values that belong to you, to your children. That's your job. You've got to have the conversations, the tough conversations. And you're thankful for the fact that your parents have had those with you, your dad in particular. But the whole point of this is that the well-being and honor of both the family and the society are entrusted to those who are called to work hard on relationships. But get this, and get this well. Peterson writes, Christian discipleship, by orienting us in God's work and setting us in the mainstream of what God is already doing, frees us from the compulsive rigors of our work. It frees us from what one has called a blasphemous anxiety to do God's work for Him. Dad, your greatest job is depending on God while forging relationships in the context of serving others. Your family, your community. You can't do it by yourself. You just can't. But you're called to do it. You're called to do it with God. Because when it's all said and done, your job is vastly important, Dad. You're shaping another generation. You're sending out arrows. You're crafting, you're polishing, you're balancing, you're forging. You're training up both comrades in arms who will stand side by side with you in the battle. And you are raising those who will be tomorrow's leaders within your faith community. So you look at the kids that are sitting in these pews. Dads, they're our responsibility. Moms, as you've been listening in on this Father's Day message, please understand the same applies to you. You're a hugely important part in crafting those young souls. Maybe you're past having children in the home. You're that elder then in the community. You have an important job in helping us as younger people whose perspectives aren't always right to keep the perspective that we need, to value what's valuable and hold out in front of us what it is that we're called to do in making disciples of Jesus Christ. Let's pray.